We're holding on Yud-Ches Amud Beis, a little more than halfway down the narrow line. The line begins Tanan Rabbanan, good morning, Adi. The line begins Tanan Rabbanan on Yud-Ches Amud Beis, about a little more than halfway down the narrow lines, and that's where we're holding. Tanan Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa. Hishmit bas sofer osiyase psukim. What happens if the sofer who wrote the Megillas Esther left out individual words or even whole psukim? The Koran HaKodesh and the Targum HaMetargim, and then the reader, the person who's reading the Megillah, read them by heart, like the way a Targum says the Targum of the Pasuk. Yotze, so he's still Yotze. Rishonim talk about that the Rashba talks about that it can't be missing the beginning or the end. It has to be that the beginning and the end of the Megillah are intact. Then if the middle of it is missing, then if the middle of it is missing, then it's fine. The Orchis Chaim says, and then Amar brings, that another point, a different point, is it can't be missing a complete topic. So therefore, so in Shulchan Aruch, it brings both of those things. So as long as it's missing an individual word or letter here or there, and he reads it Baal Peh, then that's fine. But it can't be missing anything at the beginning or the end, and it has to be that in the middle, it's not missing any one complete topic. But within that, then if it is and he reads it Baal Peh, then it's fine. Hagoris Agro actually points out that if it just meant that he reads it Baal Peh, then why the expression Keturgim on Hamatagim? So he says what it means is that you read those words not only Baal Peh, but also you read them in Lashon Targum. You read them in Aramaic. So you would think you're not Yotze because now you're reading the Megillah in two different languages, mostly in Lashon Kodesh and a little bit in Targum. And the answer is that still and the Gemara is saying that still works. The Pashtus he's talking about where the listeners understand the Targum language, because as we said yesterday, you can only read in non-Hebrew languages, only for people who understand those languages. Okay, the Gemara says Mesvi, I have a contradiction. A Braisa says Hoya Ba'osius Mitushtoshis Omikoros, if there were in the Megillah letters that were smudged or ripped, if you can still tell the form of the letter, so you may not have, the letter is not written in solid black anymore, but you can tell that there's still something showing that there was a letter there, then you yotze, v'im lav lo yotze, v'im lav psula, and if not, then it's possible. So we see, in other words, that all the letters have to be there. And the answer is like kasha haba kula haba miktsasa. There's a difference between the whole Megillah or the majority of it versus a minority of it. So if you have a small amount of the Megillah has the letters smudged or ripped or even were never written in the first place, then that's fine, as we said before. But if you have the majority of the Megillah that way, then it's no good. So altogether, in other words, it comes out that you have three criteria based on the Rishonim. It can't be missing the middle. It can't be missing the beginning or end. It can't be missing a whole inyan in the middle. And it has to be that all of these things affect only less than half of the Megillah, not half or more than half. Tanan Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa, Hishmit bra koda posik achad. What if when you read in the Megillah, you left out a posik? Lo yomer ekres kolav achakach ekra oise posik. You can't say, well, let me finish the Megillah and then I'll go back and read that one posik. You can't, because that would be reading the Mafreya, and we learned in the Mishnah that reading the Mafreya is no good. Therefore, ela koda ma'ose posik ve'elach, so you have to start from that posik that you missed and continue from there. Similarly, nichnas the base of Nessus, if a person comes into shul, umotza tzibur shakaru chetzia, he finds a tzibur that already heard half of the Megillah, lo yomer ekra chetzia matzibur v'achakach ekra chetzia, he can't say, okay, let me hear the last half of the Kriya with them, and then privately I'll read the first half for myself, because again, that would be the mafreya. Elakodos, mitchilos avad sefer, he has to read the whole thing from beginning to end. A point that one of the Mefarshim makes is what the chiddush of this over the previous case. Even though in this case it means that you're missing the kriya b'tzibur. Nevertheless, that's still you have to do that because you can't hear the Megillah out of order. Of course, if he wants to sit there and listen to that half from the tzibur and then go and read the whole thing beginning to end for himself, then of course that would be fine too. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, Misnamnim Yotze, we said that if he read the Megillah while he's drowsy, then he's Yotze. So, Heichi Dami Misnamnim. So, as the Gemara asks in other places in Shas, we had it most recently in Tainus, what is the definition of Misnamnim for purposes of Halacha? Amar Ravashi, Nim V'loi Nim, Tir V'loi Tir. Means he's asleep, but not completely asleep. He's awake, but not completely awake. Namely, Dekoru Leva Oni, if they call to him, they call his name, he'll answer. But he won't know how to answer something that takes a little bit of thought. because he's too sleepy to think of that. But if they remind him of something, he'll be able to remember it. In Psochim, for example, at the end of Psochim, it mentioned this in connection with the dinim of eating the Korban Pesach, that if you fell asleep, you can't continue eating, but if you were misnamnim, you could. So the Rashbam gives an example over there. Let's say they want to know where he put something. If they ask him, where did you put it, he's going to be too muddled with sleep to remember. But if they tell him, did you put it in such and such a place, then he's going to be able to say yes or no. Okay. Next, we said in the Mishnah, if he was writing the Megillah, and meanwhile he's reading it, or he's darshaning it, he's darshaning pasuk by pasuk, he's saying a pasuk and then giving drashas on it, and then the next pasuk and so forth, or we said, if he was proofreading the Megillah and going it over and reading it as he said, im kivin libe yotze b'chola. So we said if he has kavana of his heart to be yotze, then he's yotze. So we talked about actually in the Mishnah the possibility. It doesn't mean he actually has to have kavana to be yotze the mitzvah, which would mean the concept called mitzvah tzrichas kavana. Is that in general true? Is that true only by the Megillah because it's persumei nisa? Or maybe kivin libe over here doesn't mean at all to have kavana to be yotze the mitzvah, just means having kavana to read the words properly, as opposed to, for example, when a person is proofreading, where he doesn't always read the words properly because he's looking more, he wants to catch any chaseiros v'yaseiros, so he's going to read the words unphonetically in order to catch such things. So the Gemara says, hey chidami, when we're talking about where he's writing the Megillah and reading it, what's the scenario? Are we talking about where he's saying each pasuk and then writing it? Well, kivin libe my habi. How does it help if he's machaven? Al pavu. The fact is he's reading by heart, and we learned in the Mishnah that reading by heart is no good. So are we talking about that as he writes each pasuk, he then reads that pasuk out verbally? The prop, so then it's not Baal Peh, but still me yotza. How is a yotza with such a Megillah that's incomplete? We're going to learn on the next Amud, on Yud Tesamun Aleph, that we're going to have a machloikas, how much of the Megillah do you have to hear to be yotza? And we're going to have the opinion of Rav Meir that says you have to hear the whole thing from beginning to end. And Rav Chelboy says, even according to the other opinions, so first of all, the opinion is that the halacha is like Rav Meir, who says you have to hear all of it. And Rav Chelboy says, v'afilo l'manda amma me'ish Yehudi, even according to the opinion of Rav Yehuda, that it's enough to hear from Ish Yehudi. And then we have other opinions in the Mishnah and in the Braisa, different places where if you hear from there on, you're yotze. But even according to those opinions, they all agree. They all agree it has to all be written. So how do you have over here? For example, he writes the pasuk by Hibi Me'ach HaShverish, and then he reads that pasuk. But what good does that do? The whole Megillah is not there in front of him. The answer is, Ela de Mancha Megillah Kameh. So we have to be talking about evidently where there's another complete Megillah sitting in front of him. V'kori lamina psuka psuka. So he's reading a pasuk from it at a time, because of law, and then he's writing down that pasuk. So he has a sample Megillah in front of him. He reads from there the pasuk by Hibi Me'ach HaShverish. Then he writes that pasuk by Hibi Me'ach HaShverish. Then he reads the next pasuk by Yom Ha'im and writes it, and so forth. So that's fine. He has a completely written Megillah in front of him. Well, the Gemara says, in that case, if we understand the Mishnah that way, Lema Messiah L'Rava Baba Chana, does that mean that this Mishnah is a proof for what Rava Baba Chana says? Do Amar Rava Baba Chana Amar Rabbi Yechanan, also Lichtav Ois Achas Shalom and Aksav, you're not allowed to write even one letter of Sifrei Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah. And in this case, we're talking about a Megillah, not from a written text. So it sounds like it has to necessarily be that way, because the Kosva of our Mishnah, it sounds like we're saying, of necessity, it means that he has a Megillah in front of him. So the Gemara says, not necessarily is what Rabbi Labachana is saying proved by the Mishnah. It could just be the Mishnah is talking about a case where it so happened that he did that. Maybe he's not required to do that, but the Mishnah is describing a scenario where he did end up doing that. But maybe, in fact, it would be kosher to write at Shalom in Aksav. So let's discuss that point. Gufa, Omer Rabbi Labachana, Omer Rabbi Yechanan. So now, Rabbi Baba Chana was telling us that you're not allowed to write even one letter not from a written text in front of you. So the Gemara says, Maisvi, I have a contradiction. A Braisa says, Omer Reb Shimon Ben Elazar, Maisvi B'Rab Meir Sheholach La'Aber Shana Be'Esya. It happened once that a mayor went to Essia to declare an Ibur Yaron. Now, Essia is a place outside Eretz Yisrael. You're really only allowed to declare Ibur Yaron in Eretz Yisrael. What happened was, though, the Gemara explained, the Gemara explains in Yevamos and in Brachos and in some other places that where there's no chachamim of his caliber left in Eretz Yisrael, and it's not possible to do it in Eretz Yisrael because the Romans are harassing them or whatever, then they're allowed to go to Chutz La'aretz and do that. We find that Rabbi Akiva did that one time. He went to Babel. So now, by the same token, Rabbi Meir went to Essia, which even though it's all part of Essia, is also part of the Roman Empire, but apparently the Romans didn't bother the Chachamim as much over there, maybe because it wasn't actually part of Eretz Yisrael. Whatever the case, Sir Meir went over there in order to make calculations and declare a leap year. So while he was there for Purim, the Lo Yehoyasham Megillah, there was no Megillah there, the Kosvam Liba Bekara. And he wrote out a Megillah by heart and read it. So you see, you are allowed to write it by heart. You don't need a sefer in front of you. The answer is Amar Rav Abahu, Shiny Rav Meir. Yes, but a mayor is a special case. With him, there's fulfilled what it says in the pasuk. Literally means your eyelids will show the straight way in front of you. In other words, the pasuk is saying that you'll know, you'll be on a level where you look, your eyes will tell you which way to go, and you'll do that, and that will be the right way to do. But the Gemara is darshaning. The Gemara is going to douse him now, that it means that your knowledge of Torah goes straight in front of you. In other words, that he knows the whole Torah inside out. So he knows it by heart. So he would be allowed to write Shaloi Min Aksav, but nobody else would necessarily. In fact, Gilyon HaShas, Rabbi Akiva Eger over here, refers to a medrash in Bereshis Rabbah, and it's also in Yerushalmi later on in this Masechta, that what Meir did is, first he wrote out one Megillah Baal Peh, then he used that as a model to write a second Megillah. So the second Megillah is written Minaksav, the way it's supposed to. And the first one he put in Gniza, because even though he knew for sure that it's written 100% accurately, but because he hadn't written it Shalom Minaksav, therefore he didn't want that he or anybody else should be using it to be Yotze, so he put it in Gniza. So that way he's Mekayim everything. What does that pasuk mean? Your eyelids will show the way in front of you. So he tells him the word afapecha refers to divrei Torah. Elu divrei Torah, dichtiv vahu, where you have another pasuk in Mishlei that expresses how easy it is to forget Torah if you're not constantly reviewing it. If you fold up your eyes, in other words, if you close your eyes against the Torah, then it's going to be gone. In other words, you have to constantly be reviewing what you learn. Otherwise, it's going to be like if you close your eyes and say, you know what, I already learned this, I don't need to bother again, then it's going to be gone. Okay, herifahim. So afapecha then means Torah, which is so easy to forget by not reviewing it. Nevertheless, even that kind of thing is straight and clear by Rav Meir, that he knew the whole Torah letter perfect, and therefore for him there would be a heter to write Shalom Aksav, but not for anybody else. The Gemara gives a similar example. Rav Chista Ashkechel Rav Chananel Dava Kosev Sfarim Shalom Aksav. Rav Chista one time found Rav Chananel, who was one of his fellow Talmidim of Rab, who was sitting and writing Sfarim, Sifrei Torah B'Pashtos, not Minaksav, he was writing them by heart. Amalei, so Rav Chista tells him, that's not right. It's true that Re'uya Kolak Torah Kulali Kosev Apicha, the entire Torah is worthy to be written by your mouth. In other words, you, Rav Chananel, are very expert also, like Rav Meir, and conceivably you have the expertise. We're not worried that if you're writing Shalom and Aksav, you're going to make mistakes, which is the reason behind the Takana. Ella, Kach Omer Chachamim, but Rav Chista tells him, the fact is, the Chachamim said, also Lichtav Oysachas Shalom and Aksav. You're not allowed to write anything by heart, so don't do that in the future, even though I know that you aren't making mistakes, but nevertheless, that's the halach. So the Gemara says, let's analyze that. If Rav Chista is telling him that the whole Torah deserves to be written through you, is capable of being written through you, and he's not just, that's just not just an empty promise, and it's not just an empty compliment, rather, which means that Rav Chananel also knows the whole Torah letter perfect. Well, don't we find that Rav Meir did that? So why shouldn't Rav Chananel be allowed to do that as well? And the answer is shasat chakshaini. It's different in the case of Reb Meir, where it was an emergency situation. There's no Megillah in the whole city of Estia, so then he has no choice but to write one Baal Peh. But Reb Hananel is living in a place where there are other Sifrei Torah or other Megillahs or whatever it was that he was writing to copy from. So therefore, Reb Chista tells him, don't rely on your perfect knowledge of the Torah. Write it minaksav like you're supposed to. Okay. Another din in this connection. Abaya shara l'dvei barchovu l'michtav tefillin ha-mezuzah sh'loim ha-naksav. Abaya allowed people from the house of barchovu. That was a place in Babel. That was like their center for writing tefillin, for writing tefillin in particular. Rashi refers to a Gemara in Eilam Metzias that mentions that if you find a pair of tefillin, you're allowed to keep them, and so you have to wait until the owner shows up to give a simon, but you're allowed to keep those tefillin for yourself and give the owner the money, or to sell them to somebody else and give the owner the money if you're concerned that by the time he comes back, they may rot or something, because the owner can easily buy a new pair of tefillin by Bei Barchovu. So we see that was their center for buying tefillin. So Abaya allowed them to write tefillin mezuzahs without having a written text in front of them. They could write Baal Peh. So the Gemara says, Kiman, well, who is Abaya going like? Ki hai Tana. He's going like the following Tana of a Braisa. The Tanya, Rabbi Yirmiyah Omer Meshum Rabbeinu. Rabbeinu Bapashtos means Rebbe. Tefillin and mezuzahs nichtoves shaloi min aksav. Tefillin and mezuzahs can be written without having a text in front of you. As the Gemara is going to say in a minute, the reason is because everybody knows those parashiyas baal peh. It's one thing the rest of the Torah or Megillah. Some you have some individuals, some yechidus skula, like Reb Meir and Reb Hananel, who know them by heart, but not necessarily does everybody else, and therefore mistakes might creep in. But tefillin mezuzahs, everybody knows them by heart, so therefore you can write. Therefore, the Tana of this Braisa says that you don't need to. The Reb Yirmiyah says that therefore you don't need to write them minaksav. The ein tzriches sirtut, and also he says tefillin mezuzahs do not require sirtut. You don't have to score lines on the parchment to make sure you're writing them straight. However, the Gemara says, as far as that last one, that's not so simple. The hilchsa, the bottom line halacha is, tefillin ein tzrichin sirtut. Tefillin do not require sirtut. Mezuzas tzrichin sirtut. But mezuzas do. Now, when we say sirtut, we mean sirtut of every line. Tosfos in other places discusses, the fact is, the Gemara tells us elsewhere that you're not allowed to write words of Torah without sirtut, so that should imply that tefillin also needs sirtut. After all, they have words of Torah in them. So therefore, Tosfos in some other places says, fine, what it means is that you don't need sirtut of every individual line in the tefillin, because after all, the tefillin are going to be inside their leather boxes, inside the batim. You're not going to be opening them up to read them. In principle, in fact, according to strict halacha, tefillin never need to be checked, as long as you're wearing them on an ongoing basis. The minig is to check them twice every 7 years, like you do mezuzahs, but that's not required strictly api halacha. So therefore, there's no reason for sirtut on every line. It's not so important that the lines are straight. However, Tosfos says in other places, that you should at least do sirtut on the top line, above the top line, below the bottom line, and on the two sides, and then within that, you can write the whole thing without sirtut. That's brought in Shulchan Aruch, although then it says that if a sofer needs the sirtut in order to be able to write straight lines, because he knows he's not going to be able to write straight lines without it, then he should do sirtut on all the lines, and that's how it's generally done nowadays. A mezuzah, on the other hand, again, a mezuzah, it's true, is inside its case, but if nothing else, you have to take it out every couple of years to check it, so therefore, there's more of a reason that it has to have straight lines. In any case, that's a halach l'mesh misinai, that a mezuzah requires sirtut. So that's what it is. Both tefillin and mezuzahs, as we said, there the halacha is like Rabbi Yirmiyah and the Braisa, and like Abaya said to Bei Barchovu, that you're allowed to write them without a written text in front of you. My time of migras grisin. Why? Because these portions of Torah are very familiar to everybody, so therefore there's no concern, there's less of a concern that you're going to make a mistake and leave something out or write something wrongly or whatever. Okay. Next, the Mishnah said, Hoysik Suva Basam Mechola. We said that if the Megillah was written with Sam or Sikro or various other things, then it's possible because it has to be written with ink. So let's define these terms. Sam is what's called in Aramaic Sama, which is Rashi brings a French translation for it. It's a yellowish pigment. It's a yellowish pigment that contains arsenic. They used to use it in those days as yellow dye or yellow paint or whatever. So it's called an Aramaic sama. Sam, in fact, means poison because arsenic is poisonous. Sikra, what is sikra of our Mishnah? Amar Rav Abahana skauta shma. In Aramaic, it's called skauta. Rashi says it's a red paint that they used to use for, they used to use it for painting window shades. So I guess the idea is they could also use it as an ink. Kumus is what's called in Aramaic kuma, which is sap or gum from a tree. The word kuma is actually related to the word gum in English. Kankantum, which it says in the Mishnah you can't write with, is chauta de ushkafi, is the black dye that shoemakers use to paint shoes black. Tosfos has a little bit of a discussion about it. There's two possible candidates, what that is. One of them is copper sulfate, and the other one is iron sulfate. And Tosfos discusses which one does it mean over here. So Tosfos ends up saying that it's what's called, and in English it's called iron sulfate. And in fact, now Tosfos here and in some other places in Shas discusses the question, are you in fact even allowed to put that in the ink? In the Gemara, in some places, it seems to imply that ink is not supposed to contain kankantum at all. Nevertheless, eventually the minhag developed that you do. The standard sofer's ink that most sofrim use includes this iron sulfate as well as a couple of other things, which give it, they make a dark black ink that sticks to the parchment. Next, the Mishnah had also said that the halacha is that really it doesn't matter. Tosfos discusses over here a couple of possible recipes for ink. Again, one involving kankantum and one not. And also there's the difference. Another ingredient that they use in sofer's ink is gallnuts. So Tosfos also discusses the question whether you're allowed to use those or not. But in Shulchan Aruch it just says, listen, anything that's black and stable that sticks to the parchment and doesn't come off can be called diyoy, and you're allowed to write Sefer Torah Tefillin and Mezuzos in it. So the Maaseh, you have most sofrim use this one that involves iron sulfate and gallnuts and a couple of other ingredients. Nowadays they have various stabilizers that they add to it to be able to keep that. In the olden days you had a problem that the iron would eventually rust, and therefore you can sometimes find really old Sefer Torah where the writing in them is reddish because the iron eventually rusted. So nowadays they have certain stabilizers that they're able to add to the dough to the ink to prevent that from happening. We said in the Mishnah also that the Megillah cannot be written on diftira or niyor. So what are those? Diftira is the maliach v'kamiach v'le'ofetz. It's parchment that they've already treated with salt, they've already treated with flour, but they haven't yet treated with gallnuts, which those, the gallnuts in particular, make it white, so that, and they make it such that if you erase the writing, it'll be noticeable. So diftar, as we haven't reached that stage yet, so you can't write the Megillah on it. Tosfos points out, nowadays we don't use gallnuts for that purpose, but we use other kinds of things that have the same effect, that make the parchment white and impossible to forge writing on it, because if you erase it, as you see nowadays, you see our Sefer Torah. Nowadays, for example, if there's a place where the sofer had to erase something, then it's noticeable compared to the rest of the parchment. So that's diftira. And niyor, when the Mishnah says you can't write a Megillah on niyor, means machka, means papyrus, where they had it was a writing material. They took the stems of the papyrus plant, they flattened them out and dried them and glued them together, and it made a paper-like material that they could use for writing. But you can't use that for writing a Megillah. Okay, we said in the Mishnah, adjitek suva ashuris. We said it only works, it's only a kosher Megillah only if it's written in ashuris. And how do we know that? The Gemara says, because it says that we have to celebrate Purim according to its writing and according to its time. So in other words, it has to be according to the writing of the Jewish people. And what is the writing? What is the script of the Jewish people? So it has to be written in that. It says it has to be ala sefer uvadyoy chula. It says it has to be written on parchment with ink. So manolon, where do we know that from? So that, asya ksiva ksiva. We make a gzera shava on the word ksiva. At the end of the Megillah, it says that Esther Amalka wrote the letter telling everybody to observe Purim. You have in Yirmiyah, when Yirmiyah dictated Sefer Eicha, Megillas Eicha, to his Talmud, Baruch Ben Neriah, and then he sends it with him to read it to the king and the ministers, and hopefully they'll do tshuva. So they ask Baruch, how did this sefer come to be? By Yom Lahem Baruch, and he tells them, Mipiv Yikra Elias Kod Varma Ela, Yumiyahu dictated with his mouth all of the words in this scroll, Vani Kosev Ala Sefer, but Yo, and I'm writing it on parchment with ink. So we see that the definition of ksiva in halacha involves parchment and it involves ink. So therefore, the Megillah, so not really the definition, for other purposes in halacha, we do allow other materials and we do allow other inks. But for purposes of the Megillah, since it says here, Vani Kosev, and the Megillah, it says Vatichtev Esther, then it means that a davka has to be written in ink on parchment. Okay. The Mishnah says, Ben ir shaholach lekrach. If you have a person, now we learned in the first parak that you have two different times for reading the Megillah. You have in the regular cities they read on the 14th of Adar, and in the cities that are walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun, they read on the 15th. So what happens? Ben ir shaholach lekrach. What happens? A person who lives in a regular city, where he goes to a walled city, or ven krach shaholach leir, or somebody from a walled city who goes to a regular city. So when does he read the Megillah? Im osid lachzulam kaimai, if he's going to return to his place, and we're going to see in the Gemara when he's going to return, kode kimakaimai, then he reads like the people of his place. Avim lav kode imahin, if not, then he reads it with them, meaning at their time. So we're going to see in the Gemara some detail about that, and then we'll talk about there are different Rishonim who have different opinions about the details of that. Continues the Mishnah. From what point can a person be reading the Megillah and be Yotze? In other words, does a person have to hear the entire Megillah, or is there maybe some point in the middle that he can start from, which is good enough? Reb Meir Omer Kula. Reb Meir says he has to hear the entire thing from beginning to end, and the Gemara is going to go through each of these opinions and explain why. Reb Yehuda Omer Meish Yehudi. Reb Yehuda says, no, you don't have to hear from the beginning. You only have to hear each word from Ish Yehudi until the end. Rabbi Yossi Yemim, Achad Varma Eila, and Rabbi Yossi says you only have to hear from Achad Varma Eila from the beginning of Perek Gimel, where it talks about Haman's rise to power. Okay, so the first part of the Mishnah, where we talked about that if a Ben Ir goes to a Krach or vice versa, so Omar Rava, Lo Shonu Elisha Osid Lachsu B'Leili Yudalid. When we're talking about that a person from a regular city goes to a walled city, and we're saying that if he plans to return, he's going to read on that. So Rashi says we're talking about over here the other way around. We're talking about somebody from a walled city went to a regular city, and we're saying that if he plans to return, he reads like the 15th, and if not, he reads like the 14th. When are we talking about that he reads on the 15th? Only Lo Shonu Elisha Osid Lachzu B'Leili Yudalid. Only if he's going to be returning to his city on the night of the 14th. So on the night of the 14th, which is when the people in the regular cities are going to be laning, he's not going to be in town anymore. So therefore, there he goes back to laning on the 15th. Abel ein osid lachzu b'leila abal osir. But if he doesn't plan to, but if he's not going to be returning on the night of the 14th, he's only going to be. So Rashi describes he left the city before Alois HaShachar. So even though Rashi explains, in other words, like this. He left that regular city before Alois HaShachar. So now we're saying on the night of the 14th, even though he was there for part of the night, he doesn't need to lane there because on the daytime he's not going to be there. So therefore, you can't call him that he's part of a world, that he's part of a regular city at all. Abel ein osid lachzu b'leila abasir. But if he's not going to be returning at all on the night of the 14th, he plans to spend the entire night of the 14th in the regular city. So then kode imahin, then he has to lane with them. Then he has to lane with them on their day. He has to hear the Megillah with them on the night of the 14th. Rashi actually says he would have to hear both the night of the 14th and the day of the 14th. Rashi says the other way around also. If a person from a regular city goes to a walled city, so it depends. If he plans to not be there on the daytime of the 15th, he plans to return sometime during the night of the 15th, then he still lanes, even though right now on the night of the 14th, he's in the walled city, he still reads like the city that he came from, even though right now he's in the walled city because he's not planning to be there the entire night of the 15th. But if he was planning to stay the whole night of the 15th there, then Rashi says he can wait and hear the Megillah on the 15th, even though on the night of the 15th, even though he's going to hear, even though even though he's going to return later on. Now, there are different opinions of Rishonim among this. The Rif brings a point that it's not just whether he's there, it's what his plans were. Is it that he planned to return that night, which after all seems to be implied by the words of the Mishnah, Osid Lach Zolomakaymai, or it depends what his plans were. Is it that he planned to return that night and then he got stuck there versus where he planned to begin with to leave before the night was over? So there's that. There's the Rosh talks about the Rosh disagrees with Rashi to a certain extent about the case of the person from the walled about the case from the of the person from the walled city who went to the regular city. Does he in fact lay in on the 14th, or does he in fact say till the 15th? The Ravid argues that the Gemara means over here that if he's there on the night of the 14th, then we require him to remain there the daytime of the 14th as well in order to hear Megillah. So there are a good number of opinions about this among the Rishonim. The various opinions are brought in Shulchan Aruch. The Taz also has a long discussion about the ins and outs of it. Lamaisa, if you're going to be in that situation, then of course you ask a Rav exactly what to do. So Omar Rav, I'm a non-minalah. So Rav says, where do I get the statement of mine that there's a difference between whether he's going to be there that night or whether he's not going to be there that night? So Dichtiv, the Pasuk says, Al Kain, because of all of these Nisim, HaYehudim HaProzim HaYoshvim Ba'orei HaProzis, the Jews, the unwalled Jews who live in unwalled cities, so they celebrate Purim and they hear the Megillah on the 14th. So Rava says, look at the Pasuk. Mechti Ksiv HaYehudim HaProzim. It says the Jews who are unwalled, Lomali L'michtav HaYoshvim Ba'orei HaProzis. So why does it have to add the words, the ones who live in the unwalled cities? Of course, a person who's unwalled means that he lives in an unwalled city. So Hawk Mash Malan. So therefore it comes to tell us, the Pasuk is coming to tell us that not only we're talking about somebody, how Yehudim HaProzim would suggest the Jews who on an ongoing basis live in regular cities. Now we're saying that no. Deporus ben Yoma Nikra Porus. Even somebody who's only in the Porus for one day is called a Porus. So that's where we get. In other words, that you can have a person who lives in a walled city most of the time, but now he's in an unwalled city for one day already. Then he can be called a poruz and he reads the Megillah on the 14th. So that's what Rava is saying. That if he was going to be there the whole night of the 14th, then he reads on the 14th, even though he himself lives in Yerushalayim or whatever, or the walled city, and usually he would hear the Megillah on the 15th. But because now he's Ben Yoma, because now for one day he's a Poruz, then therefore, Hakamash Malan, the Poruz, Ben Yoma, Nikra Poruz, that just being in an unwalled city for the day itself already makes him call the Poruz. So therefore, that's what we're saying, therefore, that he then hears the Megillah the way that they lay in it in this place where he is right now. On the other hand, again, we said if he's not even going to be there all night, then we don't consider him a poruz because then he's not even there for one complete night. So then during the night, when there's a chiyuv of hearing the Megillah, he's already back in his city. And again, that's according to Rashi, where it just depends where he physically is located. Then you have, again, the opinion of the Rif, that it depends on what his plans were, and the different other opinions among the Rishonim on the details of this. Okay. So the Gemara says, Ashkechon Poruz. Fine. So from that pasuk, we see that concept as far as a Poruz, that a person can be living most of the time in a walled city, and now he happens to be in an unwalled city, and we're saying that he lanes the Megillah like the way they do in the unwalled city. Mukaf Menolon. Where do we see that it works the other way around, that a person who lives in a regular city can be considered a Mukaf if he's there for the one day? And the Gemara says Svarahu. That we can learn from Svarah. Mide Poruz ben Yoma Kori Poruz Mukaf ben Yoma Kori Mukaf. Given that somebody can be a Poruz for being one day in an unwalled city, then by the same logic, a person can be can be considered a Mukaf if he's in the walled city for the one day. Okay. V'Amar Rava. Also, Rava says here's another din in this connection. Ben Kfar Shaholach Leir. Suppose you have a villager who came to the big city. Now, we learned in the first Mishnah of Ar Masechta that the Bnei HaKfarim, that the people of the villages in those times, had a special dispensation from the Chachamim that they could lay in the Megillah earlier than the 14th, on the 11th, 12th, or 13th, whichever was the Yom HaKnissa. So now, suppose this person, Rashi says, he heard the Megillah on the Uliyu day, on the Yom HaKnisa. Now, he's in the big city, and he's there on the night of the 14th of Adar. So, ben kach or ben kach, korei mahen, either way, whether he plans to stay there, or whether he doesn't plan to stay there, either way, he has to hear it together with them. So, in other words, Rashi says, even though he heard it a few days ago, he still has to hear it again. Tosfos wonders about that. I mean, what's the logic? Why should he have to hear the Megillah again? Okay, Tosfos says the fact is that he is in a walled city. I mean, in a regular city. So therefore, the halachas of the regular city apply to him. Tosfos discusses that there can be a difference between whether they're just coming into town for a couple of hours and then leaving. Versus where they're staying in the city the whole night, like we said before. Anyway, so by the Kfarim, we say that Ben Kach or Ben Kach Korei Mahem, even if he plans to leave before the day, he still has to hear the Megillah with them by night. My timer, why? Hai Kibnei Ir Boilam Mikri, because essentially, it's not like when it comes to the regular cities versus the walled cities, we said that was originally part of the Takana, that the walled cities do not celebrate Purim on the 14th. They celebrate and they hear the Megillah on the 15th. So their time is the 15th. The 14th is not yet their time. Really, the villages, Hai Kibnei Ir Boilam Mikri, really, they should have, the people in the villages should have to lay in like the larger cities. But Rabbanan Hu Da'akilu Al Akvarim, the Chachamim made a kula for the villages, Kedesh Yisapku Mayim Mazen La'achem Shebekrakim, in order that they should have the time and the ability to supply water and food to the people who live in the cities who don't grow their own food. Or the Gemara had discussed that before, and we ended up saying it wasn't Kedesh Yisapku, it was Mishum Shemesapkin and Mipnei Shemesapkin, because they supply it, therefore the Chachamim gave them this bonus. So therefore, Hani Miliki Isibiduchte. Fine, but that only applies when the guy is in his village on Purim. He's not going to be in the big city on Purim because he only came there the last Yom HaKnisa. So therefore we allow him that dispensation to lay in a little earlier. Avo ki ise ba'ir, but when he's in the city, kibnei ir bo'i lamikri. He has to read like the people of the city, because after all, essentially that is his time to lay. So, Abaya asks Rava, what do you mean? Didn't we learn in the Mishnah, Ben Krach Shaholach Le'ir, or actually a Braisa says, Ben Krach Shaholach Le'ir, if a person who lives in a walled city went to a regular city, a Braisa says, Ben Kach or Ben Kach Koda Kimakoyme, either way, whether he plans to stay in the regular city or not, he reads on the 15th, which is like the place where he lives. So Abaye himself says, before I use this braisa to ask on Rava, we have to say, Ben Krach Salkadaydach. What do you mean? How could the braisa be talking about a person from a walled city? How can the braisa say that either way he lanes on the 15th? Didn't we say in the Mishnah that it depends on whether he plans to return before Purim is over or not? So evidently, we have to correct the braisa and say that it's talking about a villager, and it's saying ben kach or ben kach, either way, he can read like the people of his place, which means not like Rava. He would be allowed to read on, he already heard it on the 11th or 12th or 13th, and he's allowed to have been yotze with that, and he doesn't have to hear it again on the 14th. So what are you, Rava, telling me that if he's in the city on the 14th, he has to hear it on the 14th? So the Gemara says, listen, Balav Terutzi Metarutzis. After all, you anyway have to correct the Braisa, because as it is, the wording of the Braisa said Ben Krach, and you anyway having to correct it to Ben Kvar. So you might as well correct the rest of the Braisa. Tony, Kodi Imayan, you change the Braisa to say that it means he reads together with them. In other words, there's obviously already a mistake in the Braisa. We can't assume that the Tana of this Braisa got it accurate. So maybe the Braisa didn't mean to say that he lanes according to his place. Maybe it actually meant to say that he lanes together with them, meaning like Rava said, he has to hear the Megillah on the 14th, because that's where he is now, in a place where they lay on the 14th and where they don't have the dispensation of Yom HaKnisa. The Mishnah had continued, Mehechan Kora. So that's the halacha. I mean, the part about the Kfarim we don't have is not halacha l'maisa nowadays, because as we said in the first parak, that whole concept of the Kfarim laning early only applies when Beis Din was Mekadesh the Chodesh, and most Jews live in Eretz Yisrael, so it doesn't apply nowadays. But as far as the Ben Krach and Ben Ir, that part still applies, of course. And again, you have the different opinions of Rishonim and Achronim that we were talking about before, what exactly the scenario is, when he would hear like people where he is now versus when he has to hear the Megillah on his actual, on his regular day. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, Mehechan Koda Odomas HaMegillah V'Chola, from what point does a person have to hear the Megillah in order to be Yotze? So we had three opinions in the Mishnah. We had Reb Meir saying you have to hear the whole thing, Reb Yehuda saying only from Ish Yehudi, and Reb Yossi saying only from Achad Vonam Eila. And we learn in a Braisa, Tanya, Reb Shimon Yechoyim and Balayla Ahu, Reb Shimon Yechoyim has a fourth opinion that you only have to hear from Balayla Ahu, the beginning of Perek Vav, in order to be Yotze. Amar Reb Yechanan v'cholon mikra echad doshim. Reb Yechanan says, actually, all four Tanoim are getting their opinions based on the same pasuk. The pasuk says, V'tichtev Esther Amalka u'Mordechai Yehudi es kol toikin. Esther Amalka and Mordechai Yehudi wrote all the strength. So what strength are we talking about? Manda Amakula, Reb Meir, who says that you have to hear the whole Megillah from beginning to end. He says, Tokvish Shalachashverish. That the takana was that you have to hear the entire strength, the entire story of the strength and the power of Achashverish. And right away at the beginning of the Megillah, it starts talking about that. The point is, Reb Meir says that really highlights the nest that even though Achashverish was such a mighty king who ruled over 127 provinces, nevertheless, we were saved from the Gzeira that happened under his reign. So therefore, you have to hear the whole thing. Umanda Amam Ish Yehudi, Reb Yehuda, who says that you only have to start from Ish Yehudi, he says, Tokbe Shal Mordechai. What you have to hear about is the strength of Mordechai. And so only from beginning, from Ish Yehudi, is Mordechai introduced. So therefore, you only have to hear that. Umanda Amam Achad Vonam Eila, the opinion that says that you only have to hear from Achad Vonam Eila, Reb Yossi, holds Tokbe Shal Haman. He says, what you have to hear is about the strength of Haman. And Haman is first introduced over there. Okay, we have Memuchan and Perak Aleph, and Memuchan, the Gemara said, Zeh Haman, but we have Tosfos bringing that the Memuchan is actually Daniel, and in any case, there he's not introduced as Haman, as the oppressor of the Jewish people. Umanda Omim Balai Lahu. Now Reb Shimon ben Yochai, who says that you have to only hear from Balai Lahu, because he says Toikbish on Ness. What you have to hear is about the strength of the Ness, and only really beginning from Balai Lahu does the Ness really start happening. Everything else up to that point is only like setting the stage for the Ness to occur. Okay, so that's why they have the different opinions. Reb Huna Omim Mehoch. Reb Huna says there's a different pasuk that they're all basing themselves on. The pasuk continues over there. Actually, it's a few psukim earlier. It says it summarizes at the end of Perek Tes. It summarizes the events that led to the establishment of the Purim. It says Umar ro'u al kocha. What did they see regarding this? Umar higia alehem, and what occurred to them? In other words, that the Megillah is saying there's something with each of the figures in the Megillah. Where why did they see? What made them act in a certain way? And what did they see? In other words, what motivated them to do? Al kocha was because of such and such. Umahi gialeim, and what were the consequences? So let's go through. Manda amakula, the opinion that says you have to hear the whole Megillah, says it means like this. Ma ro Achashverosh nishtamish b'kelim shal beis hamikdash. What was Achashverosh thinking when he used the kelim of the beis hamikdash at his party, which is at the beginning of the Megillah? So the reason is al kocha, because of this, because as we learned in the previous parak, mishum dechashiv shimin shnin v'loy ifru, because he made his calculation of when the 70 years of Golos Babel are supposed to be up, and he saw that it wasn't over, so he thought that the Jewish people are not going to be going out of Golos. Oh, so therefore he figured that it's safe for him to use these kalim. Umar higia aleihem, and what was the result? What happened to Achashverosh? Dekoto Vashti, that he wound up killing Vashti. So according to the mayor, the words Umar ro akocho, Umar higia aleihem, are referring to what Achashverosh did and the consequences of it, all of which are in Perek Aleph of the Megillah. So therefore you have to hear the whole thing from Perek Aleph until the end. Umanda Omam Ish Yehudi. Now, Reb Yehuda, who says you only have to hear from Ish Yehudi, he says what the pasuk means is Ma Ra Mordechai D'Ikni B'Haman. What was Mordechai thinking that caused him to provoke Haman by not bowing down to him? The reason is Al Kocha, because of the following: the Shabi Nafshei Avodah Zarah. That Haman had made himself an Avodah Zarah. In other words, if it hadn't been for that, Mordechai wouldn't necessarily have had a problem bowing with him. Okay, you know, you bow in respect to a king's prime minister. But because Haman had made himself an Avodah Zarah, therefore Mordechai didn't do that. There are actually Tosfos in a couple of places in Shas that discuss that just because Haman made himself an Avodah Zarah, actually, just because he's declaring himself, I am a god, wouldn't necessarily be a reason enough to not bow to him, because the fact is, you're not accepting that he's a god. You're bowing to him out of you love him or you fear him or whatever. So that wouldn't be. So Tosfos discusses in various places in Shas that we don't just mean that Haman made himself an Avodah Zarah. He had an image of Avodah Zarah on his chest. So therefore, that's actual objective Avodah Zarah. And therefore, Mordechai wasn't going to bow to that. Or Tosfos says, maybe even if we say that Haman, that's just that Haman had declared himself an Avodah Zarah, technically, Alpi Halacha, Mordechai might have been able to bow to him then. But Mordechai wanted to make a Kiddush Hashem and show that he's not going to do that even in that example. So in any case, so that's what we're saying. So what made Mordechai do that? Is Al-Kocha is because he saw that Haman was making himself an Avodah Zarah, and therefore he realized he had to make a Kiddush Hashem. Umahi Giyah Alehem, and what was the result? The Isrichish Nissa, that the Ness happened. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says, you have to read from the beginning of the part where we introduce Mordechai. Now, of course, the question is, so what? I mean, the whole story of him provoking Haman only begins in Perek Gimel. Why, according to Rabbi Yehuda, do we have to begin from Ish Yehudi? So Marsha points out, we learned in the first Perek, that a person who denies and rejects Avodah Zarah is called a Yehudi. Therefore, we need to start right away from Ish Yehudi and stress that that's why Mordechai wouldn't bow to Haman, because he was a Yehudi who doesn't believe in Avodah Zarah. Next, Umanda Amma Me'achad Varam Eila, the opinion Rabbi Yossi in the Mishnah, who says that you only have to hear from Achad Varam Eila, he learns the pasuk Umar Ro Al Kocha, etc., as follows. Ma Ro Haman Shneskana B'chol HaYehudim, what did Haman see, what motivated him to get jealous and hate all the Yidin? Al Kocha, the reason was, it was provoked by the following, Mishum De Mordechai Lo Yuchav Le Yishtakva, because Mordechai wasn't bowing to him. And what was the result? What was the consequence for Soloisiv Esbanav Allah 8 that he and his sons were hanged on the gallows? So therefore you have to read from that part in order to realize that cause and effect. Umanda Amim Balailahu, Reb Shimon Yochai, who says that you have to hear from Balailahu. He explains the pasuk, Ma ra Achashverosh lahavi a sefer hazichronos. What motivated Achashverosh on that night when he couldn't sleep to bring the sefer hazichronos? Al Kocha, what motivated him was what had just happened, Dizaminta Esther Lahoman Bahadeh, that Esther had invited Haman to the party together with her and the king. And as we learned in the first parak, we had a dozen or so reasons why Esther did that. And one of them was in order, in fact, to arouse Achashverosh's suspicion. So now Hitaka is suspicious. Why is she inviting only Haman? So therefore he has the Sefer HaZichronos, Umahi Gialem. And what was the consequence? The Isrichish Nissa, that the Ness happened. So Amar Rav Chelva, Amar Rav Chama Baguria, Amar Rav, Halacha Kedivrei Omer Kula. The Halacha is like the opinion that you have to hear the entire Megillah from beginning to end, like Rav Meir. But Afilu L'mando Amar Ish Yehudi, even according to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, that you only have to hear from Ish Yehudi, and similarly with the other opinions, Tzricha Shteik Ksuva Kula, you have to have the whole thing written. As we said before, the Rashba says you can't have the beginning or the end of the Megillah missing, and as the Orchas Chaim that the Ramah brings says, you can't have an entire Inyan missing in the middle. So the whole thing has to be written. Okay. Here's another din that the same Amora says, that the same chain of Amoraim says. Megillah Nikris Sefer V'Nikris Igeres. Now, when you look at it, in the Pesukim there, in Megillah Esther, the Megillah on the one hand is called in several places a Sefer. For example, it says V'Nichta V'Sefer, meaning that it has the dinim to a certain extent of a Sefer Torah. On the other hand, in the Pesukim over there, it's also called Igeres. Igeres HaPurim, Igeres HaPurim Azos HaShenis. So therefore, in a certain sense, it's like a letter, which means that it doesn't have all the dinim of a Sefer Torah. So what does that mean? Nikris Sefer, it's called a Sefer Torah. So we said at the top of the Amud that it has, for example, it has to be written on parchment with ink like a Sefer Torah. But now there's another point. Shem Tofra B'chote Pishtan P'sula. If you sew together the sheets of a Megillas Esther with linen or with any other thread, then it would be possible. It has to be like a Sefer Torah that it's sewn together with gidim, with threads that are made from the nerves or whatever it is, of the sinews or whatever of an animal. The Nikris Igeres, on the other hand, it's called an Igeres in the sense Shem Hitubo Shloisha Chute Gidin Ksheira, that if you put in it three threads of Gidin, then that's enough for it to be kosher. It doesn't need to be the entire thing. Rav Nachman says those three threads of Gidin have to be Meshuloshim. Now, you have several opinions among the Rishonim what that means exactly. Rashi explains, the Rashi that we have in front of us was corrected by the Maharam Shif. The third word in the Rashi, Shiyu Meshaloshin, is a tefer, which means that Rashi says from the beginning of the sewing. Maharam Shif says it's actually supposed to be Meirosh HaSefer, from the beginning, from the top of the scroll. So Rashi learns, in other words, that you have to have, that you divide up the height of the scroll into four and you put stitches of gidim in at each of those junctions between one part and the next. So there should be, let's say, in other words, the Megillah is let's say 20 inches tall. So you have 5 inches from the top until the first stitch of gidim, then 5 inches from there to the next one, 5 inches from there to the next one, and 5 inches from there to the bottom. So in that way, you have that it's divided into quarters, but you have the distance between each stitch of gidim is equal to each other and equal to the space from the top of the Megillah to the bottom. Tosfos brings an opinion, but doesn't like it, that says that it means that you have to have the gidim at the top, the bottom, and the middle. And then the Rambam has a different explanation also. Mishaloshin means three stitches of gidim, not just one. So Lamaise in Shulchan Aruch, it says, if you, in that situation, you don't have enough gidim to sew up the whole thing from top to bottom, then what you should do is, it says, you combine together all the opinions. So you do like Rashi and divide it into quarters, and at the end of each quarter, you put three stitches of gidim, which satisfies the Rambam's opinion that you need three. Then you have, in the remaining, let's say, 5 inches, on the top and the bottom, you put one stitch in either place, and that satisfies the opinion that Tosfos brings, that you need stitches on the top, the bottom, and the middle. And then the rest of the stitches can be with linen threads or other threads if you need to. This is, by the way, it's interesting. The Meiri over here says that you can't be using linen stitches at all. He learns all it means is a Sefer Torah has to be stitched completely from top to bottom without any gaps, whereas the Megillah, if you have to, you'll have gaps between the stitches. But he says you can't use linen threads at all. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't even bring his opinion, because the Sfarim of the Meiri were actually not known at the time when the Shulchan Aruch was published, and even later on when they were, the Poskim don't bring it as something that you have to be machmir on as well. They're saying that you can continue to do, like it says in Shulchan Aruch, and use linen stitches in part of it. This is an example of where you have that something that was discovered later is not necessarily used in Paskening Halacha, even though, I mean, the Meiri was a respectable Rishon, and we learn his Sfarim, but to use them to change the already accepted halacha when his Sfarim were discovered, then that we don't necessarily do. Okay. Here's another din, as far as reading the Megillah. Hakoda b'Megillah k'suva ben k'suvim. A person reads from a Megillah that's written among the other k'suvim. So imagine you have a scroll of Sifrei k'suvim. Rashi points out that all of their Sfarim in those times were scrolls. So you have a scroll of k'suvim, and in between, so you have in that scroll, you have Tilim, Mishle, Eov, etc., and the other k'suvim. And in the middle there, in its place, you have Megillah Esther. So lo yotza, so you're not yotza reading from such a Megillah, because no pesumei nisa, it looks like you're just reading part of Tanakh. However, Rava says that's only if the section that has the Megillah is not any longer or shorter than the other ones. At Porta, a little bit. If you have, let's say, the rest of the scroll is 20 inches tall, and let's say you have now the part with the Megillah is 22 inches tall or 18 inches tall, then that part is noticeable, less longa, then there's no problem, because then the fact that it's not the same height as the other ones makes it noticeable that you're reading it as a separate sefer. In this connection, by the way, they're showing and bring the whole concept that another point we just said the Megillah is called the Nigeres is why when we read the Megillah, we don't keep it rolled up like the Sefer Torah. We open it up, we unfold it, and we fold it into folds like an Igeris, like a letter. So they're showing and discuss that in context of this Gemara over here. So that would work also. If you're folding it like an Igeris, wouldn't that also be noticeable that you're reading it like a Megillah? So it seems that maybe in the time of the Gemara, they didn't yet have that minhag. That minhag of folding it like an Igeris, we first hear of it in the time of the Goyim. So the Gemara tells, Levi bar Shmuel have a kakori kameder of Yehuda, the Megillah aksuva ben aksuvim. Levi bar Shmuel was one time reading the Megillah in front of Rabbi Yehuda, in a Megillah like that, which was part of a larger scroll of aksuvim. Omrulei, Rabbi Yehuda says, you can't do that. Hare omru akori b'megillah aksuva ben aksuvim lo yotza. Didn't the Chachamim say that you can't be yotza with such a Megillah? So the Gemara says, there are actually details in that. Omru b'chir ba'aba omru b'yechanan, hakori b'megillah what we just said, but after the Bechir Ba'aba said that, he hit it on the head. In other words, he pointed out there is an exception to that. It's not a blanket statement that you can never lay in from such a Megillah, unless, like we said, it's a different size. So he hit it on the head. In other words, he said there's an exception to that, but Sibur Shanu. That rule only applies when you read the Megillah but Sibur. The Yachid, you could be reading using a Megillah that's written among the Ksuvim, and there's no problem with it. Another din, another similar din that has a similar structure, where Rabbi Ba'aba says a din in the name of Rabbi Yechanan, and then partially, and then says it doesn't apply in all cases. Of Rabbi Ba'aba or Rabbi Yechanan, shear hatefer, the fact that you have to leave a little bit of the urea unsown at the top and the bottom, halacha l'moshe misinai. So in other words, when you look at a Sefer Torah, where one sheet is sewn to the next one, you'll notice it's not sewn all the way to the bottom. There's a little bit of a gap at the bottom, which is left unsewn. So that, Rav Chiya Ba'aba is saying that is halacha l'moshe misinai, umachu la'amocha, but again, he hit it on the head, meaning he said it's not really halacha l'moshe misinai, v'loy amru ela kadesh lo yikareya. Meaning that really the Chachamim only said that rule only for practical reasons so that it doesn't rip. If it's sewn all the way to the end, then if the Sefer Torah accidentally gets stretched, then it's likely to rip in the middle of a urea. At least like this, when you have the top and the bottom of each seam in the Sefer Torah are left unsewn, if the ureas are going to rip, they're more likely to rip apart at that seam. And therefore, at least then you can sew it back up afterwards rather than it rips in the middle of a urea and you may not be able to fix it. Another thing that Rav Chiya Ba'aba said, "V'amr Rav Chiya Ba'aba Amr Rav Yechanan, il mole nishtayer b'ma'ara sh'amr b'moshev elio kim loy nekev machat sidkis." Like this, you have in Parshas Kisiso, you have Moshe stands in a cave, and Hashem shows him his glory. And Hashem says to him, "V'sakoisi chapi alachad avri," that I'll show you my ani aver kol turi al panecha. I'll show my glory to you. And he named Makam Iti, there's a place with me, you'll stand in the cave in the rock, Sakosi Kap Yolecha, and I'll cover you, Kavyocha, with my hand until I pass, and then Veroisa Sachorai. So and many years later we have Eliyahu, and he also comes to that same cave and has a vision of Hashem there also. So Il Molin is Shtayab Ma'ara, if there had been left open of that cave, Sha'omad Bamosha Eliyahu, where Moshe and Eliyahu stood in that cave, if there had remained open in that cave, Kim Loin Nekev Machat Sidkis, even a little hole the size of a sewing needle, which is a very tiny hole, Loiho Yichodan Laman Neoda, Moshe and Eliyahu would not have been able to continue standing and existing in the face of the intense light of Hashem. In other words, there was such an intense light from the Gilui of Hashem over there, of Hashem's Shekhinah, that if there had been, that the entire cave had to be completely sealed, not even a drop of light should penetrate. Shenema, the pasuk says, "Ki lo yirani hodem b'choy." No person can see me and live. So therefore, if they had seen even the tiniest fraction of Hashem's light, then they wouldn't have been able to withstand it. Their neshamas would have left their bodies. Rashi brings a second explanation that a machat sidkis is actually not a different explanation. Rashi points out, you have a machat sidkis is a tiny little needle like you use for sewing clothes. We're not talking about over here about a large needle like you use for sewing sacks. We're talking about the tiniest possible needle. Okay. What does it mean when Moshe said that on the luchos which Hashem gave me, there were written on them all of the things that Hashem spoke to you on the mountain? So what do you mean all the things? Mean at Melamed from this Milun, that Hashem showed Moshe all the little details in the Torah. When we have, Rashi says, when it says S or Gam in the Torah, and we have a ribui from that we learn a din from that, or where it says, for example, Ach or Rak, and we learn a miut of a din from that. So all of those Hashem showed and taught Moshe. V'dikduke sofrim, also the details of what the sofrim, the Tamana Chachamim of later generations, what they derived from the Lashon of the Torah and from the Lashon of their predecessors. And Hashem showed Moshe everything that the Sofrim, everything that the Chachamim of later generations are going to be Mechadish. Namely, specifically, we're saying that Hashem showed Moshe the fact that the Chachamim in later generations are going to make the mitzvah of laying the Megillah. So that was ready. In fact, it's interesting. The Rambam brings at the beginning of Sefer HaMitzvahs, you have the Shoshim over there where he discusses how we know which mitzvahs count as the 613 or not. He brings that there were earlier Moniah mitzvahs. He brings there were earlier Chachamim who counted the 613 mitzvahs who said that, for example, Mikra Megillah counts as one of them. And the Rambam says, absolutely not. It was made hundreds of years later. How can it be considered one of the mitzvahs that were given to Moshe Mitzrayim? So there is, in fact, an argument to the contrary that says, Gemara over here says that Moshe Rabbeinu was shown it. Nevertheless, though, the Rambam's Minyan HaMitzvahs became the most well-known one, in particular the Sefer HaKinuch follows it, and therefore we count Mikra Megillah as one of the Zayin Mitzvahs D'Rabbanan. Even though it was shown to Moshe, nevertheless, it's still credited to the Chachamim, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, who gave us that mitzvah, and it's counted as one of the Zayin Mitzvahs D'Rabbanan. Okay?